Welcome to In Plain Legal. I'm DNA High Easton, and today we're making the law something everyone can understand. You're watching Now Media Television. Welcome to In Plain Legal, the show where we break down how the law shows up in real life without the jargon or lectures. I'm your host, DNA High Easton. Today, I'm joined by attorney Malia Wilson, a dedicated family law attorney known for her compassion, professionalism, and zealous advocacy. With experience across divorce, custody disputes, child support, and adoption, she helps clients find fair and effective solutions in some of life's most difficult situations. Malia, I'm so glad you're here and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. In this first segment, we're diving into what divorce can really feel like, a war zone. For many, it's chaos, betrayal, and feeling powerless over decisions that affect your life and your children. Malia is here to shed light on how to navigate that process. Divorce often feels like chaos with no roadmap, leaving people unsure of how to protect themselves and their children legally and emotionally. Malia, what are the first legal steps someone should take when they decide to divorce but feel overwhelmed and don't know where to begin?
So I think the first thing to do is just find an attorney in your area that practices family law and reach out and schedule a consultation. Some attorneys will have free consultations and some you have to pay for a consultation. No matter whether you're paying for the consultation or it's free, just reach out to, I would say, multiple attorneys for multiple consultations. That way you can find someone who fits well with you. It's not always about who's the most expensive or who's the cheapest. It's who do you build a connection with? Who do you feel will represent you the best? And who do you feel most comfortable with? Because it is a difficult process. So you want to make sure you feel comfortable with someone that you're going to be sharing a lot of your deep, dark secrets with.
I completely agree. I mean, as an attorney myself, just like you, we have to make sure that we're listening to the clients and we can give them the best kind of roadmap in giving them the best legal advice. So how can someone protect their children's well-being emotionally and legally, even while there is conflict?
So personally, I always recommend that my clients look into therapy for their children. Whether it's someone that can testify in court or would testify in court is a different story, right? Just have your kids in a space where they feel comfortable talking with someone that isn't you, that isn't dad, that isn't mom. A lot of times children will tell their parents what they want to hear because children want to make parents happy. But that doesn't mean that they're always saying what they feel or what they see as being their truth. So you want to make sure they've got a space that's safe to them to air out how they're feeling.
You know, you saying that just goes to show that you are the right attorney that people need to call, because you're not just thinking about the parents going through the divorce itself, but you're also trying to make sure that children are also taken care of, because at the end of the day, we know that these parents are fighting for the benefit and to be with their children and make sure that their children are safe and protected, even going through the midst of child custody and or divorce.
Yes, and I mean, it's hard on adults, but it's also hard on children. And I can't tell you how many times I have parents that say, oh, well, but my child and I are very close. My child can be honest with me and upfront with me. And that may be the case, but you don't know if they're going to feel comfortable talking to you about this process and about how they truly feel going through a custody battle or a divorce, right? So even if you don't keep it up forever, right, have them have that space where they feel safe, at least while you're going through the process.
That's amazing. I'm really glad that you do that for your parents and for all of your clients, because it's important to make sure that their kids are protected. So what are some common mistakes people make early in the divorce process that cost them time, money, or peace of mind?
I think one of the biggest issues that people in general have, right, especially with a divorce, is their emotional tie to it. You're hurting you're going through a lot. And that's typically when people make the most mistakes, right? I mean, we're all human. I know I would be struggling with it as well, personally. And I feel like a lot of things are typically said or done, especially at the very beginning of a divorce, that can hurt people in the long run. Basically, when things start to get bad between you and a spouse, you need to make sure you're on your best behavior, that you are expecting that everything you're doing or saying is being recorded, or could be used against you. With custody cases, a lot of times parents will try to be overly protective of their children. Well, dad or mom isn't gonna feed the children the right things, right? That's one thing if your child has a food allergy that's gonna be dangerous to them, and it's another if your spouse is feeding the kids chicken nuggets and you want them to have a cleaner, healthier diet, right? You can't use a difference of parenting in that type of setting as a bad thing. It's not something that's going to hurt that parent as long as they're feeding their child, right? There are just so many times that people get in situations with children where people are too focused on their differences or the hurt that they're feeling because of a spouse being unfaithful or that type of thing, instead of thinking about what is in the best interest of my child. And a lot of times people forget the most basic necessity for a child is usually having both parents in their lives, knowing that both parents love them and want to spend time with them, is huge for a child. And I think that gets overlooked too often, especially at the beginning, while the emotions are the highest.
You know, it's really great that you're able to break it down to that core value, especially when people are going through a divorce, because they do lose sight of that. And when emotions are really, really high, it's hard for people to remember why they're doing it, and then they have a hard time with even settling or even going through the process of a divorce. So it's really good that you're able to break down that concept.
Yeah, stepping back, as you know, being a formerly working in family law, right,
Yes.
is it's not easy for people to accept that or to step back, like you said. Whether they are being told what the core values are, what the core things they should be thinking about are, it's still, I mean, when someone is hurt, right, you do things you wouldn't normally do. And so, a parent seeking their own therapy can also be super helpful in the process and making sure your child's best interests are met instead of just what you want.
That is a very good point. So, along those kind of same lines, how do you help clients find fair solutions for property division, especially when there are emotional attachments involved?
So every case is different. I think that what's fair to one person is not necessarily what's fair to another. So a lot of times I go back to, I'm a book nerd. So I go back to, here's what the law says, here's what the statute says. This is what you could get if you go to court, versus we want people to try and reach a resolution on their own through mediation, through informal settlement negotiations. And in order for them to do that, right, they need to be aware of what the law says. I think if you can get something that would you'd get under the law, or if you could get something a little bit more than what you may get out of, if you may get more in settling versus what you would get if you went to court, right, I think that is a fair, good deal for someone. Now that might not be what they wanted, or it might not be what they see as fair. And I think that's where it really comes from the attorney, is needing to direct their clients and make them very aware of what their rights are, what they're entitled to under the law, but also not misleading clients, right? I can't tell a client, if we go to court, this is what's going to happen, because you never know what's going to happen if you've got a jury trial or a trial in front of a judge. You just don't know what the outcome will be, no matter what the law says.
That is very true. The fact that you are able to break that down and tell them and have those conversations, I think it sets the tone and it sets some intention, and it's very clear. I mean, you being able to communicate that to your clients is what's most important, because it helps them to be able to make the decisions to have fair and reasonable outcomes that's based on each client that you have. That's really great. So how can people, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think one of the things too that makes a big difference is having those discussions early on, right? Not waiting till the end. When people come in and talk to you, and you get an idea of what their assets are, what the property is, what they're wanting, right? Not dragging them along and making a client think they're going to get something that they're not otherwise, you know, they're not entitled to. So the only way they would get that is if the other party agrees. I think that needs to be something that is discussed with a client up front.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your insights, and we'll be right back. Coming up, we'll talk about prenups and postnups, why planning ahead may be the key to peace instead of surprise chaos later. Stay with us. We'll be right back with clear explanations, practical advice, and the legal insights you need without the jargon. This is In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm DNA High Easton, and you're watching In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. Let's continue breaking down the law together. We're here with family law attorney Malia Wilson. In this segment, we're looking at prenups and postnups, topics that can feel awkward to bring up, but often save couples from bitter fights later. Planning ahead for financial clarity in a marriage can feel like mistrust, but the reality is it prevents future conflict and ensures fairness for both partners. Malia, what is the difference between a prenuptial and postnuptial agreement, and when does each kind of make sense?
So a prenuptial agreement is done before marriage. A postnuptial agreement is done after marriage. And in the state of Texas, postnuptial agreements are allowed. They're not necessarily done in other states. For instance, I'm from Oklahoma, and when I lived in Oklahoma and studied in Oklahoma, they weren't allowed in Oklahoma. You could have a prenuptial agreement, but not a postnuptial agreement. So every state is different. So I think it's important to know what the law is in your state. but generally speaking, if you've got a prenuptial agreement, they're very good if you're coming into the marriage with assets, especially let's say you've been married before and you've got children, right? You want to go into a marriage and make sure your assets are protected for your child. That could be a good reason to do a prenuptial agreement. Another example would be just if you want to set ground rules. This is what's going to happen. You know, we want to have children. And although you can't include specifics for a child, you could include specifics for financial for having a child. So for instance, as a woman, right? Most of the time, if a woman is going to have a child, we're going to take off a certain period of time. And some women choose to stay home with the children. Some men do, right? Mm-hmm. So a postnup can also be good for this, just like a prenup, but a postnup, if you and your spouse decide we're going to have children, one spouse makes significantly more than the other, or even if you guys make similar amounts, right? If I'm going to stop working for so many years to raise our children by agreement, you likely want something in a postnuptial or prenuptial agreement to provide for the person that's taking time off, that is from their career, from their job, because most of the time, parents aren't, or just people, right? We're not going to make up for the time that we've lost or missed. This comes from, right, a lot of times I've got a stay-at-home parent that is going through a divorce, and they'll never be able to make what they could have if they didn't stop working to raise their family. Mm-hmm. Yet they're only getting, roughly speaking, 50% of the estate, sometimes a bit more, going forward. So they're just by the very nature of our laws, are going to be in a worse position than the other party. So that's a really good reason to have a postnuptial agreement or prenup. Another good reason for a postnuptial agreement is if one parent is going to, or one spouse is going to stop working, so that the parties can move to a new state or a new location. You know, your family might not be around, you might not be able to get the same job or be paid the same if you move somewhere else. So I think leading up to a big move, a big change in lifestyle, right? If you're gonna have children, those are, anytime you've got a big change in life, would be a time to consider, or at least talk to your spouse about, well, what happens in the future? What happens if we do this, or if I do this?
That's a good point. And I think, you know, sometimes people even do postnuptial agreements because they didn't have time to do it before they got married, right? So like they have those conversations, but it's just been too quick. The wedding is too quick. So they got to make sure that they can still outline those things in a postnuptial for them. But, you know, you just mentioned about talking to your partner. So how do you talk to your partner about creating a prenup without it feeling like mistrust?
So I think that's going to be each person and up to each couple as to what feels right, what feels comfortable. I know for me personally, my husband and I, when we were talking about having a child, we had these discussions. And for us, it didn't feel like we were breaking trust at all. It was just having a conversation about finances and our future together. You know, I feel like most strong relationships, you should be able to be comfortable having that discussion. If you're not, it's going to be hard to get a prenup or a postnup, which you feel is fair to both parties. Because you still have to agree on it, right? You have to agree on all aspects of it. You can't just say, oh, well, I agree to this, or my spouse doesn't want this, but I want it included. That's not how it works.
I mean, the nature of that, right, is if they don't agree on it and they're already married, then that's what leads to a divorce. I mean, that's why people get divorced, because they can't come to a form of agreement during their marriage. And so it's time for them to kind of separate. So that makes a lot of sense. Well, what terms are commonly included or should be included that you think, in your opinion, to protect both people fairly?
So one thing that I recommend is, I've seen agreements that are done very well. And I've seen agreements that are done just by couples together, right? Mm-hmm. To make sure that it's done properly to start with, right? If it's not done properly, it's not going to be enforceable. Even though Texas is a state that it's very hard to get out of a postnuptial agreement or a prenuptial agreement. But I've seen ones that are drafted and it's a matter of a few sentences, and it says, you know, if there's cheating, then this happens. Well, the problem is too often people leave too much out. And so you've got to be super detailed. You know, if you're going to have a cheating clause in, you've got to define cheating. You've got to have that talk of, for both spouses, what does cheating look like? Is it emotional? Is it sexual, right? There's so many different things that can go into cheating, that has to be discussed and that has to be included. You know, I think that, like I said previously, if one parent or spouse is taking off for a significant period of time, or is in a sense going to be losing money if you were to get divorced, right, based off of what they could have made, I think that there should be provisions in a prenup or a postnup for that individual, and to help account for their loss of financial stability. I think that a lot of times people will go the easy route, which is, you know, anything I make stays mine, anything you make stays yours, mm-hmm. which can work, right? But the more changes you put in that, and the more you grow as a couple, I think a lot of times people tend to regret those agreements. Oh, well, I didn't care about it when we got married, but now it's 20 years later. And if you hadn't done all the things you did and stayed home or XYZ, then this person wouldn't be making what they're making.
Right.
So you've got to think about that. And I think for each couple, it's different. And I think that every couple should make sure if they're, contemplating any type of an agreement like this, that they talk to an attorney. Again, have a consultation with an attorney or a few attorneys, and find what fits. Find if whatever you want in the agreement is something that an attorney feels can be enforced. Because there's no point in spending money to get something that's not going to be able to be enforced.
That makes a lot of sense. And so what I'm hearing you also say is that the more detail-oriented you can make your agreements, the better it's going to be enforceable in the courts, especially in Texas.
For some things, yes, there's a very straightforward form or format that the courts use for most prenuptial and postnuptial agreements. So there are a lot of things that are just laid out that need to be included, or that specific clauses, that type of things that need to be included. But you should speak with an attorney, right? Because a lot of people will get stuff from online and it doesn't have all the different parts it needs to be enforceable under our state.
And have you, in your professional experience, have you seen a prenuptial agreement get thrown out before?
So I haven't tried one where the prenup or postnuptial agreement was thrown out. I have had ones that the parties have basically come to an agreement that it's not enforceable. And so the parties together just reached an agreement. This was a divorce. They just reached an agreement in their divorce, throwing out this postnuptial or prenuptial agreement, because both parties, both attorneys realized there was no possible way it was going to be enforced in
That
court.
makes sense. That makes sense. And so, I mean, the key here is to get an attorney to be able to draft all of your prenuptial and postnuptial agreements. So, Malia, if viewers want to learn more about how these agreements can protect their future, where can they reach you?
So they can reach out to me through my website at waukee-wilsonlaw.com. They can also reach out to me via email at info@waukee-wilsonlaw.com. We've got a Facebook page, we've got a LinkedIn page, and also just by calling my office. Our phone number is 281-942-4052. And I've got staff that's ready and willing to take your calls and help get you set up for a consultation so that you could talk with us further.
Thank you so much for sharing all that information, and we'll be right back. Up next, we'll tackle one of the toughest challenges in family law, high conflict custody battles, and what to do when cooperation breaks down. Stay with us. We'll be right back with clear explanations, practical advice, and the legal insights you need without the jargon. This is In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm DNA High Easton, and you're watching In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. Let's continue breaking down the law together. Welcome back to In Plain Legal. I'm here with attorney Malia Wilson, and now we're talking about high conflict custody disputes. When cooperation breaks down, emotions and costs skyrocket, leaving parents feeling stuck and always defensive. Custody conflicts can escalate into costly and emotional battles. Knowing the right legal strategies and support systems is critical in protecting children and parents alike. Malia, what legal strategies exist when mediation or negotiation fails in high conflict custody cases?
So it depends on where we're at in a case, right? So a lot of times there are going to be two mediations that people will attend. One prior to temporary orders, which is gonna, it's where you set the ground rules for what's gonna happen in the case. And the other is usually before a final trial. It is my belief that every case should be, we should be looking at every case as if we're gonna have to try it, right? The more information you have in a format that can be used in court, the stronger your arguments are at mediation, right? The more you can push at mediation for what you want because you've got stuff to back up what you're saying. So a lot of times, if you don't settle in mediation, you're going to go to a hearing in court, whether that be for temporary orders, for a final trial. There are multiple other things that we could have hearings on, but you want to be preparing before you get to that step. You don't want to just wait until you don't settle and then say, okay, now we've got to do all this work. It needs to be going on throughout the case because discovery can take quite a bit of time. Depending on what county you're in, will change how much time the court will give you, or if they'll give you one reset or two, as well as how long they'll allow each of those resets to be. Also, I mean, a case just in general is supposed to settle or be finalized within a year. Obviously, there are exceptions to that. But I mean, discovery, just to respond to it, you've got 30 days, right? So you're looking at a month for someone to get stuff together, not to mention drafting those requests, reviewing those requests, right? Reviewing the responses, if other information is needed, sending out additional requests. So it can be a very lengthy process. And I don't think anyone should wait until mediation, especially a final mediation, to start preparing what's needed for trial.
That makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, obviously, you and I are both attorneys, so we understand the process of discovery, but can we just break that down a little bit for our viewers who might not necessarily know what that means? Can you just explain what discovery is, especially in the context of family law cases?
Yes, so discovery is something that's offered in all cases, right? Under civil procedures. Now, what it is it's an information gathering part of a case. It is where we are trying to find out who are witnesses, what would witnesses say or testify to, what documents do you have that back up either the other party's allegations or back up what our arguments are. So with it, there are multiple forms. Many people have seen on TV or heard about depositions. That's one format. It's request for production, which is the request for documentation or documents. There's requests for interrogatories. Those are written questions basically to another party. And you're limited on those. There's also requests for admissions. It's where someone is basically admitting or denying a very specific statement. So those are the main forms. There's disclosures as well. But there's also discovery that can be done on third parties or on basically someone that isn't in your case. So if there's a business, for instance, right? The business, it can be a part of a family law case. However, it's not necessarily. It will depend on the nature of that business. Is it a corporation? Is it a partnership? And so you may need to subpoena or request records from that business. That would also be a part of the discovery process.
Thank you so much for sharing that insight. And so basically, discovery, as we know, is a way to gather and present evidence in court to show what's in the best interest of the child or even for the family law court itself if there's a divorce or any other type of family law case. So in this situation, what role do you feel professionals like therapists, custody evaluators, play, and how do you engage with them in your high conflict child custody cases?
So there are tons of therapists that are great therapists. There's a ton of child custody evaluators. There are psychologists, forensic psychologists. There are all these different experts that can be used in family law cases. For instance, a child under 12 can't testify in court without an exception. And for a child under 12 that's maybe been going to therapy or talking to a therapist or a psychiatrist, right? that person may have insight that they can provide the court to how that child is doing. And especially if we're talking about a modification, so we're modifying a prior order with a child, or if you've gone through temporary orders. The reason why that makes a difference, in my opinion, is because you're talking about a specialist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Treating this child, but there's a pattern. There's a pattern of this child's with mom on these days and dad on these days. And how is the child reacting when they're with both? So those specialists can testify then to the court and provide the court with insight the court might not otherwise get. With, as an attorney, right, our job is to not only be talking to that specialist to find out what their thoughts are, what's going on, what can I be doing as an attorney of mom or dad, to try and help make sure things are moving the way they need to for the child. Sometimes having someone like that can also provide an attorney with insight. Hey, my client's doing something they shouldn't be doing. And so we can address that head on and put something in place to try and protect my client then, so that we're not showing up in court to all this stuff that we didn't know about, and not having a way to protect my client from that. So a lot of it is just interacting with that specialist to try and find, get insight, to learn what they know and what they specialize in and apply that to our case and how to protect my client, as well as the children.
That's good. And then in doing so, can you explain to our viewers what the standard is for parents that are going through the process to gain custody of their children? What are they trying to strive for to be able to prove who's going to go with what parent?
Oh, Lord.
I know. So, I did it.
Huge question.
It is.
The most basic way to answer it is best interest. The court looks at what is in a child's best interest. So many factors go into that. The courts are looking at, you know, the child's mental well-being with both parents, the stability of housing with both parents. A lot of times there's something we refer to as a Disneyland parent. That parent is usually the parent that's fun, that buys all the gifts, that the kids get to do what they want with. Not necessarily what's in the child's best interest, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times then there's also your parent that's strict and has lots of rules and do your homework, do X, Y, and Z. If you don't do this, you know, you're going to get in trouble. Might not be the child's favorite parent, but maybe what's in the best interest of the child. So even if, and a lot of people have heard about kids being able to testify once they reach a certain age, and that's true. Mm-hmm. However, the only thing that children are testifying to would be which parent they want to be the primary, to be able to designate the primary residence of the children or the child. Now, obviously the court could talk to them about other things, but they could say which parent they want to stay with, right? But again, that's one factor. And mm-hmm. yes, it weighs a lot in the court's decision, but it is just one factor of many. And so you really have to look at all the factors, all the different things that go into a child's best interest. Is the child being taken to school on time? Is the child missing a lot of school? You know, if so, whose period of possession is it? How are the child's grades? Is the child turning in homework when they're supposed to? What about a child being sick? Are they sick a lot with one parent and not with the other? Is one parent taking them to the doctor regularly and the other isn't, right? So many factors. And it's not just that. It's also how parents co-parent. So if you are being hard to deal with and you're not trying to build a healthy relationship with your child's parent, that can also look very bad on you. Because like I said, I don't know if it was this segment or the last segment or the one before that, courts want both parents to be in the children's lives, if at all possible. And so the more as a parent we can facilitate that and do what we can to make sure that other parent has as much information as they need to be a part of our children's lives, right? The better. And so lots of stuff goes into it. But bottom line is what's in the child's best interest.
The amazing thing about what you just said is we know that there's a lot of factors involved, right, with these courts and everything. The beautiful thing that you are doing is that you are setting expectations early and you're trying to gather all that information early on so that there's a better expectation for parents to know exactly what they need to present to the court to show that standard that their child is in the best interest regarding which parent the child needs to go to, which is amazing. Well, we'll be right back. In our final segment, we'll dive into divorce for high net worth couples and why it's about much more than just splitting assets. Stay with us. We'll be right back with clear explanations, practical advice, and the legal insights you need without the jargon. This is In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. And we're back. I'm DNA High Easton, and you're watching In Plain Legal on Now Media Television. Let's continue breaking down the law together. In our final segment, we're talking with Malia Wilson about divorce for high net worth couples. When major assets, businesses, and investments are involved, the stakes get higher and the risks of mistakes get bigger. High net worth divorces require navigating unique issues like business valuations, hidden assets, and tax implications, while still working towards fair and honest resolutions. Malia, what unique legal issues do high net worth divorces face, like business valuations, retirement assets, and investments?
A lot. So to try and narrow it down, right? Obviously, the more assets you have, the higher tax implications there are going to be. The law allows for some things to be protected from tax implications. But the higher the net worth, the more likely you are gonna be to needing a tax attorney, right? Someone else that practices tax law to come in and help with that. Not just that, right? A CPA can be instrumental in a high net worth case because they can help us determine which assets our client wants or which clients are going to be most beneficial to our client. You know, when we're talking stocks, when we're talking retirement accounts, investments, CPAs can help a lot, right? They mm-hmm. can determine what things are going to help give our clients the most bang for their buck, depending on their age, right? Depending on their employment and if they intend to work X number of years or if they're retiring, which assets do our clients need in order to receive the most income monthly going forward? So multiple different people can come in on higher net worth cases. You mentioned business evaluations. Those are also huge. A business evaluation could be as cheap as, you know, $5,000. It could be $50,000 or more. It all depends on the size of the business, the type of the business, the type of evaluation being done, who's doing the evaluation, right? So there's so many different aspects that are different when it comes to a high net worth case that you don't necessarily have on a normal case. Or at least where there may be the need for someone else to come in and help due to their expertise that we wouldn't otherwise have.
So, I mean, with all that being said, obviously there's a team of experts that you can work with as a family law attorney. How does that typically work, if you can kind of explain to our viewers about that?
So it can happen in a multitude of ways. One being, you know, we could say, all right, we need a business evaluation done. And here are some different evaluators that we recommend. And, you know, let our clients speak to those different evaluators and figure out which one they feel most comfortable with. A lot of times the client will hire the specialist or the expert. Not our firm. So that's not always the case, but typically that's the case. It's the same thing with if I'm going to have a CPA or a tax attorney, a business law attorney, right, come in, I want my client to make sure that they feel comfortable with whoever this person is. I'm obviously going to give them suggestions. I'm going to give them my opinion as to why I would prefer this person over another. But at the end of the day, I feel that that is a decision for my client to make, and not for me to make. So they get the information, they get the names, and then they can reach out and talk to those experts directly. And then we can move forward from there once an expert's been retained by our client.
Okay. So, I mean, a lot of people they ask this pivotal question. They've asked you, they've asked me, what can someone do to protect their business or separate their assets before or during a divorce? And we kind of touched briefly on that again, but I want to just see if you can kind of reiterate it just one more time for me.
Yeah. So people can do postnuptial agreements. They can do prenuptial agreements. If the property itself is separate property, then it may already be protected through statute and through just the law itself. So it really depends on what the asset is that you're trying to protect. Again, if you have a business that you've set up or you're setting up, or you've got separate property you're getting inheritance from a family member, or you had money coming into the marriage, right? Talk to an attorney. Talk to someone that can help you with that. Especially when it comes to businesses, a lot of times the business has their own contract, right? Their own agreement that outlines what's going to happen in a divorce or what can happen for that person's interest. Those are all things that need to be considered when the business is being set up, as well as that plays a role in how a business can be divided, if it can be divided, or if we're talking about here's how much a business is worth and we're going to have to take the money from elsewhere because we can't split the business or we can't do anything with the business or the party's interest in the business.
So with that being said, I mean, how do you ensure that both parties are disclosing all their assets and debts honestly?
So there's multiple ways.
Yeah.
If someone wants to hide assets, they can hide assets. Mm-hmm. I mean, if someone's got a lot of cash somewhere, unless you know about it, it's hard to find, right? The way you would deal with that type of thing is through witness testimony, through tracking charges and expenses that someone's incurred. You know, someone saying they don't make any money, but they're making money under the table and they're getting paid in cash, yet they just bought a $1 million house, right? There are records, whether it's from what they're spending and instead of it being from what they're making. Another thing that we can do is we can subpoena records, which means we're basically requesting the records directly from an institution, a person, a group, outside of the parties. So let's say we did request for production and the other party doesn't produce what they're supposed to, or they produce some stuff, not all of it, or we think that the records have been altered or doctored, right? Then we're going to also subpoena those records to make sure we have the whole picture, to make sure that what we have is correct. A lot of times in bank statements, you can see transactions from other accounts, right? Which may help you determine, okay, now I need to subpoena from Chase Bank instead of Bank of America, right? So just reviewing documents themselves can a lot of times aid you in that, right? Doing depositions can aid you in that. One thing that people are supposed to do, in at least in Montgomery County and Harris County, is provide a sworn inventory. Basically what that is it's each party outlining, here are all of our assets, and I'm swearing that this is true and correct. With that being done and filed with the court, if later on someone comes back and says, well, this wasn't disclosed, and wife had this asset, she didn't include it on the inventory, you come back and you can say that that was, I mean, one of your arguments, right, is that that was done in bad faith, that this asset, whatever it may be, was intentionally kept from the parties, was kept from the court. And now you're asking for that asset to be divided in a fair and just manner based off of the party's neglect or failure to produce or include that asset.
Which we know is a very dangerous game. It's a very dangerous game. I mean, especially too when it comes to property. I mean, can you just speak on a little bit about can anybody come back later, even if it's not disclosed, but are they allowed to divide property at a later point in time after they already get divorced?
They can. And not only can they, sometimes in mediations, if we don't feel that we have the whole picture and we're concerned about someone hiding assets, we can include in a mediated settlement agreement, that if an asset isn't disclosed and a party later discovers it or finds out about it, the party that failed to disclose loses 100% of that asset. So basically, if Dad fails to disclose a retirement account, and mom finds out about it after the divorce is final, then 100% of that retirement account can then go to the mom. Obviously, it's what was in the account throughout the process. We're not talking about 20 years later, that person getting all of it. However, depending on how it's written, that's possible. Courts also will, when they're trying these issues or looking at these issues, right, can put a more heavy hand on a party for failing to disclose under tort claims and stuff that would normally fall outside of the family law structure to penalize parties for failing to do what they're supposed to do.
Wow. Well, Malia, this has been incredibly helpful. Where can people find you if they'd like to learn more or get guidance with their own situation?
So my firm, Waukee Wilson Firm PLLC. You can also look us up online, waukeewilsonlaw.com. We've got our phone number is on there, but it's also a way to reach us. That's 281-942-4052. We can be reached through email at info@waukee-wilsonlaw.com. We also have a LinkedIn. We've got Facebook. So we're on multiple different forms of social media. And so we'd be happy for anyone to reach out to us and get a consultation scheduled so that we can discuss your matter further.
Malia, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights.
Of course, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, from navigating divorce and custody disputes to planning ahead with prenups and handling high net worth cases, you've shown us that with the right guidance, even the toughest legal challenges can be managed with fairness and clarity. And to our viewers, thank you for tuning in to In Plain Legal. Remember, the law touches our lives every day, and knowledge is your best protection. Until next time, I'm DNA High Easton, and this is In Plain Legal on Now Media TV.